Next case is 061420, Walter Kidd, the Universal Security. Mr. Hahn, are you ready? Give us your 5 minutes of development.
Yes, sir. At this court, my name is Maurice Hahn, representing the defendant appellant, in this case, Universal Security Instruments. This case is at once a relatively simple and complicated procedural matter. In this case...
Almost like a final exam question, civil procedure.
Yes, it very much so. In this case, we really have three grounds that we are pursuing in context of reversal of the lower court's judgment, but dismissal of the action. But primarily, I think we do need to address the Federal Circuit's jurisdiction in this case, because I suspect that's probably important at this stage. And that is, in the event that the Federal Circuit believes, this court believes, that the lower court's dismissal of the action did not include dismissal of USI's counterclaims, then there is an argument that there was no final judgment. However, this court's precedence in HR Technologies, which we cited in our brief, tends to indicate that this court does have jurisdiction by virtue of the dismissal of USI's counterclaims.
But your claim is the district court did dismiss the claim.
Yes, we have. Yes, we do.
In fact, I looked on PACER, and it indicates, by the way, that the case has been terminated by the district court. And that's the district court's own entry into PACER. So I think that would substantiate your claim that they did, in fact, dismiss your counterclaims.
As long as we can dispose of the Federal Circuit jurisdiction issue, then I'd like to move on to the grounds for reversing that dismissal. One is that the judge dismissed in the lower court the case while a motion or before making a determination on the standing, e.g. the subject matter jurisdiction of the plaintiff. Whether or not the plaintiff in that case had standing had to be determined in order to determine whether or not the court had jurisdiction over the matter complained of originally by Walter Kidd.
And if it didn't have subject matter jurisdiction, what kind of dismissal would it have been?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, it would have had to have dismissed the complaint, but because several of the counterclaims advanced by Universal Security in part turned on the fact that the plaintiff did not own the patent, it was wrongfully asserting a patent it did not own, then we were deprived at that point of pursuing those claims independent of the fact that they didn't own it would have been established at that point, and the court could have heard our complaint or our counterclaim.
But your initial point, in your initial argument, as I understand it, is that the court was not permitted to voluntarily dismiss the case in the presence of a standing motion of this sort. And you say that under Fourth Circuit law, which we should look to for those sorts of things, there is a non-precedential opinion, Short, but no precedential opinions. And it seems to me that Short would be directly on point, but for what I think is a critical difference. And tell me if I'm wrong here. In Short, the defendants opposed the voluntary dismissal. And in this case, you stipulated to it. You stipulated, the record shows, as far as I can tell, that your party stipulated to the voluntary dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint, not of your counterclaims. I agree, you preserved your right on that all the way through. But you st- voluntary dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint. Now, that is the critical difference that I see between your case and Short, because in Short, they maintained all the way up through appeal that the plaintiff's complaint should not have been dismissed voluntarily, but rather the court had to resolve the standing motion.
Actually, Your Honor, I don't recall us stipulating to dismissal. What we did was we agreed to dismissal with prejudice, but opposed dismissal without prejudice, for the very reasons that we would be burdened in prejudice, or USI would be burdened in prejudice, by the redoing of the case, the loss of the long history of litigation at that point.
So I'm getting it wrong, you didn't stipulate to dismissal?
No, Your Honor, we did not stipulate to dismissal without prejudice, that's a certainty. We opposed that, as a matter of fact. And I direct your attention to Appendix 841 comprises a page including an argument, the first line, with the heading being Giddy's claim should be dismissed with prejudice.
How was the lack of standing raised in the court below?
Well, originally, Your Honor, we recognized that there was a question. We had filed a Rule 12 motion for lack of personal jurisdiction to dismiss or transfer of Maryland for lack of personal jurisdiction and or improper venue. In that original document, he made the representation to the court that it appeared from the records of the United States Patent and Trademark Office that in fact the plaintiff did not own the patent. At that point, when they filed their opposition to that motion, it became clear because they did not present the writing. Once challenged, they did not present any kind of proof that they owned the patent outside of the declaration of an employee who was not present at the time. In our reply, we pointed out to the court in North Carolina that in fact it appeared now that there was no they were not the owner and they were the improper party to bring the suit. Therefore, there was no subject matter jurisdiction. That was not addressed. That point was not addressed, unfortunately, by the lower court in its ruling, judgment filed by Judge Bullen, in his ruling on the Rule 12 motion for dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction and venue. We had, in the meantime, filed a declaratory judgment action in Merrick, recognizing that we then would have the first filed case in the event that the subject matter jurisdiction was recognized.
But at that point, you filed it against.
Pardon me?
At that point, you filed it against Walter Kidd.
That's correct. That's correct.
Even though you were still alleging that they did not own the patent.
Well, at that point, they had obtained this October 3rd, 2003, self-styled confirmatory assignment.
So let me have a look. I'm curious to know the practical ramifications of what your arguments are. If I've understood it correctly, you're saying that this court should reverse the North Carolina court and send it back for that court to decide whether or not at some time in the past Walter Kidd owned a patent that it said it owned, but it turned out maybe it didn't. While there's still litigation going on in Maryland against Walter Kidd involving the same issues, right?
No, Your Honor. No. The Maryland action was dismissed. Dismissed by Judge Quarles by virtue of the decision by Judge Bullock in which it was argued by Walter Kidd that Judge Bullock had made the decision that the court had A, subject matter jurisdiction, and B, that the personal jurisdiction over the defendant was appropriate in North Carolina. So Judge Quarles in Maryland, not giving appropriate comity to Judge Bullock's decision, dismissed the Maryland action, right, and we proceeded from that point on to fight the in North Carolina. So essentially, in terms of prejudice to the defendant, it was that we were now fighting the years-long battle in North Carolina until the literally the eve of trial.
And at that point, the dismissal was entered.
The dismissal was entered actually after the trial was originally scheduled, because we were at a pre-trial hearing and it was raised in a motion to eliminate. Now, it's a little complicated because the Judge Bullock retired in the meantime. Judge Tilley took over the case, and Judge Tilley in North Carolina had not been privy to the standing arguments. In a motion in limine, it all came out in the arguments of the final pretrial conference and hearing on the motions in limine. It came out that Judge Tilley was very concerned about the subject matter jurisdiction question and gave leave to Walter Kidder to establish that, in fact, it owned the patent. In lieu of making that showing, Walter Kidder dismissed the first action and filed a second action on the same day. That was November 28, 2005. Right? Later, the judge then ruled on the motion to dismiss in March, and we took the appeal.
Counsel,
he ruled on a motion to dismiss under Rule 41.
Yes, Rule 41A2.
While we're still on the issue of the confirmatory assignment of the patent, there's one copy of it, A106, and there it shows that MIT, which was the original SIMD, which was listed, transferred to Walter Kitty, not by assignment, but by acquisition of assets. Is that correct?
Well, that's the argument that they were making in 2003. This acquisition, which was a very substantial document, only produced in March of 2005, the purchase agreement, only produced in USI in 2005, demonstrated that, in fact, the lawyers had made a drafting error. We'll concede that. The lawyers in that case had made a drafting error.
What respect?
They had identified the wrong owner of the patent in this 100-plus page document. And therefore, nothing transpired thereafter. And the wording contained within the rest of the document, which was an issue that was addressed at this eliminated hearing before Judge Tilley, the language appeared to be in subjunctive and future tense. Nothing was effectuated as a result. And therefore, it was our position that there was no writing satisfying the requirements to establish that Walter Kidder was, in fact, the owner of the patent.
Well, did the court make any determinations as to whether or not that transfer was by operation of the law of Walter Kidder back in January 24, 1997?
No, that was exactly the point that Judge Tilley had requested Walter Kidder to establish, and he gave him the lead, postponed the trial, gave him lead to demonstrate to him that, in fact, the 1997 purchase agreement did transfer the...
But by operation of law?
Well, by operation of law, Hong Kong law, probably, but we weren't even concerned about controlling law.
Otherwise, what you're talking about here is that the assignment, the confirmatory assignment of the patent would be a non-pro-tunk type of an assignment.
At best, yes, Your Honor.
If it's anything at all.
Yes, yes.
That would not establish standing on a non-pro-tunk basis for the patent back in the original file.
Yeah, June of 2003. And in fact, that non-pro-tunk assignment was obtained only as a result of our August communication to Walter Kidder, indicating that it did not appear that they owned the patent.
But counsel, the result of a standing motion, if we do send it back, if we agree with your assessment that the Fourth Circuit in the short decision And by the way, the Fourth Circuit in Short is not precedential, and it says, has a line something like, we follow other courts along. I couldn't find any other courts that said it. Could you? I mean, did you have any other citations to it? I didn't see any other regional circuit citations in your brief, so I'm guessing there aren't any, and it's a non-precedential decision. So
well, Your Honor, there's actually...
were there other regional circuits that have similarly held that in the presence of a standing motion, you can't issue a voluntary dismissal?
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to respond.
That's okay. Well, I saw a notation to that effect in Short, but I couldn't find the cases personally. You all didn't cite them, so I'm guessing maybe they're not there.
I can assure you we look for the Federal Circuit.
I'm sure. Well, okay.
We're not successful in that contest.
I wanted to ask you, but even if we send it back and say, no, you should have ruled on standing first, the district court judge, of course, has the discretion to dismiss with or without prejudice as a basis, a conclusion with regard to his standing determination, even if he finds there was no standing at the time.
Yes, Your
Honor. Then the only result is going to be a dismissal, just like the voluntary dismissal, and then he has a choice of dismissing with or without prejudice at that point.
And or with or without conditions, which is the alternative, and we have...
You had all that in front of him. You know it's going to go back, and it's not going to change, right? I mean, you know, procedurally, you might be right. And maybe we should send it back on this basis, but it's not going to probably change the outcome.
But your entire issue, though, is with respect to the counterclaims. And with respect to the counterclaims, then you should not have dismissed the counterclaims outright. Moreover, if you do go back, you also have a detrimental determination against Walter Kitty, which you want to maintain with respect to their expert witness.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
But wouldn't the district court be free? I agree with HR Technologies being a precedential decision, of course, of this court, and this panel has no right to deviate from it. And it seems to suggest that the dismissal of your counterclaims was improper in this case. Now, you will agree with me, won't you, that it is a dismissal only of your counterclaims unrelated to ownership of the patent. For example, your counterclaim of non-infringement or invalidity, to the extent that counterclaim was filed when Mr. Kidd did not own the patent, you would not be able to maintain that counterclaim against him because he would not be in a position to defend the validity of the patent. His defense would be irrelevant if he was not an owner of the patent.
If I may respond to 2 points. First of all, Walter Kidd is a very large corporation. It's not an individual.
Okay, that's fine.
Very large corporation owned by United Technologies. Secondly, in terms of the adverse determination or the determination of ownership, that plays into the Sherman count and the unfair competition counts that were...
Yeah, I just want to make sure we understand each other. You had 11 counterclaims slash affirmative defenses. Most of them went to whether the 181 patent is unenforceable or invalid or not infringed. Those should not be remanded to the district court under these circumstances because if he had no standing or was not an owner, then those counterclaims could not be preserved and moved forward on against that individual. Is that correct?
Well, against the plaintiff, that would be correct.
Yeah, because HR Technology says you send back the ones that didn't have anything to do with that. And my review of your counterclaim would suggest that is the ones related to the Sherman Act and the Unfair Competition Act and maybe the patent misuse as well.
That's not the issue.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
What's the... I know we're over time, but go ahead. And this may just be more of what you said in response to Judge Moore's questions, but I'm trying to understand what the harm is to your client if things stay as they are right now. Is there their second the kid to kid or kid?
Kid. I it's kid. Kid.
Okay. In the second litigation that's currently pending. Are all the same issues available to you as in the first one? Is there anything that would be different, other than the fact that you want to hang on to an adverse evidentiary ruling? Is there anything different in the second?
Yes, there would be.
What's that?
And that would, as a matter of fact, in response to Judge Moore raised the patent misuse issue, right? The patent misuse defense. An adverse determination on subject matter at this point would tend to support. It would prove, it would be a large chunk of the evidence that we could rely on to establish the patent misuse and the unfair competition. If, in fact, that disappears before, or it disappears because the court is sustained in its dismissal at this stage, we lose that opportunity. We would have to go back and basically argue about a position that had existed in the past and not present.
So you would still be able to argue those historical facts. You'd still be able to put in evidence to say they didn't have it at the time. You want the benefit of a court finding that they didn't have it because you want a jury to look at that and say, oh, the court said that, and you want the added oomph that comes with that. Okay?
That would be correct, Your Honor. Okay. Yes.
Which you also have to, if you go back on the present basis and they can prove standing because they can prove that the contract back in 97 transferred title to them, would that really eliminate some of your arguments?
It would, Your Honor. It actually would. But they were given the opportunity to do so, and we submit that by dismissing the action, coupled with the obtention of a November 2005 further document indicating ownership, which they used in connection with the filing of the new suit. That document, and unfortunately that's not in this record, but we would submit that it is, by their own conduct, an admission that they did not, in fact, have standing, particularly in June 2003.
But you could still argue that in the new case.
We could, Your Honor. Yes.
Finally, one last question. If you went back and you right away got a ruling on standing, that would have a substantial impact on the potential damage award in this case, wouldn't it? Because your damages would then be capped, of course, to the period of time of ownership. And I could see how that might be very valuable in helping to resolve this case via settlement or some other mechanism.
That could be helpful. Yes, that is true.
In theory.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Will, we still have 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Underhill.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please report?
We'll add a few minutes to your time also if you need it.
Appreciate it, Your Honor. My name is Al Underhill. I'm Merchant of Minneapolis, and my associate with me is Keith Sorge. Your Honor, I'd like to start out by addressing a question that Judge Moore raised first. The short case, Your Honors, in our view, does not stand for the proposition that the district court in below had to decide standing before it decided our Rule 41A motion. And the first point on that is that, in fact, USI did not raise that issue before the district court, and we would contend that, therefore, they waived the argument here that the court should have determined standing before ruling on.
I heard Mr. Kahn say they may not have had a formal motion, but when the facts came to light, they told the district court about it and made their pitch. Do you disagree with that?
I agree that, number one, they had no Rule 12 motion for dismissal. They never filed a Rule 12 motion for dismissal in the case. Your Honor, they had contested standing or raised the issue of standing from the beginning of the case when they filed their answer and counterclaims. They never brought a motion on that issue. They took discovery on that issue beginning in January of 2005.
But isn't the reason they never filed their motion because they couldn't get from you guys until the last possible minute the actual agreement transferring ownership?
No, Your Honor, that's not correct.
In the absence of that agreement, I don't see how they could have necessarily proven it.
They raised the issue early in the case, as I said, in filing their motion for dismissal for improper venue. They cited an alleged lack of ownership. We submitted an affidavit of the president of our company at the time that said that the ownership of the patent was transferred as of, according to this 1997 purchase agreement. Though that his declaration was a part of our submission in response to their motion. Now, early in the case, I suggested that the parties could take some discovery relating to that motion, and USI declined to do that. In other words, they didn't take any discovery. They didn't
ask you for that 97 ownership?
No, Your Honor.
They never asked you for that?
They asked for it after the court had denied their motions for transfer of improper venue. Then the parties submitted discovery requests.
And prior to that, they probably were trying to get the case transferred back to Maryland, weren't they?
They were, Your Honor.
Their motion was for lack of personal jurisdiction and improper venue.
Right, Your Honor. They didn't move under Rule 12 for dismissal for lack of standing.
But at that point, once they did not obtain that, then they asked for the standing issue.
They started discovery. Both parties started discovery. They asked for the agreement. In January of 2005, which was 10 months before the trial date, in response to their discovery, we produced a redacted portion of the agreement, which were the relevant sections of the agreement relating to the transfer of intellectual property. And, by the way, those are the only portions of the agreement that either party has ever relied upon, either here or in the district court. And then by March, we produced an unredacted, complete copy of the agreement. So to get back to your question, Your Honor, the issue of standing was in the case. It's been in the case from the beginning. But in the Short case, which the Fourth Circuit, non-presidential decision, there was specifically a Rule 12 motion. And the Fourth Circuit said there that this was the Fourth Circuit's statement of the issue before it. May a district court dismiss an action pursuant to Rule 41B where there is an outstanding motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
So you're saying it's not the issue of standing, but rather the technicality, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but rather the technical filing of a motion to dismiss that inhibited the court from dismissing voluntarily in that case.
That's what we believe distinguishes the Short case from the situation here.
Did they never actually make such a motion to dismiss for lack of standing? They never made that motion at any point in time in the course of the proceedings below?
No, Your Honor. The issue arose on the eve of trial in connection with a motion in limine. It was a motion in limine which they brought to exclude Kidda from producing any evidence on the ownership issue other than the evidence that they had produced during discovery. That was how the issue arose. And then the arguments on that motion, that was when the district Judge Tilley said, I think there's a problem here.
Well, I'm curious, how could they, motion or no motion, if the standing issue is jurisdictional, once the district judge is apprised of it, how could anybody waive it?
We're not suggesting that they waived the issue. They were ready to try the issue, Your Honor. Both parties were ready to go to trial on all the issues, including ownership, validity, infringement, and damages. Nobody was waiving the jurisdictional issue. But we were ready to go to trial, and that's when the judge said, wait a minute, I don't know if I want to undertake the effort of going to trial if it turns out that the ultimate conclusion is that Walter Kidda, you didn't have standing when you first filed this complaint in 2003.
So there was no subject matter jurisdiction at that.
That's right.
So that was the issue that the judge did ask you to brief and to present.
Yes, he asked us, he gave us an opportunity to come back in and try and convince him that 1997 purchase agreement did in fact establish the transfer of the patent as we contended that it did. And we still contend that it does. We looked at that issue, Your Honor. We found no additional documentary evidence that would support outside of the agreement that we had in our hands.
So is your argument that by operation of law, that agreement transferred title to the patent?
That is our argument and was our argument there.
But you also have Hong Kong law, as I understand it, applying to that agreement. Was there any evidence submitted as to what Hong Kong law would be applicable to
this? As part of what we went back and did when we talked, when the judge says, I want you to come back to us and try and convince me that you have standing here. We looked at the issue, we looked at the applicability of Hong Kong law, we looked at the fact that we'd have to address Hong Kong law issues, we looked at the fact that we were likely to have to bring in parole testimony from witnesses regarding the contract. And at that point, we felt that if this was such a concern that Judge Tilley did not seem likely to want to go forward with the case, that the most expeditious way for Kidda to get to the merits of its infringement claim was to move for the voluntary dismissal of the case and refile Kidda 2, having obtained in October of 2003 the assignment document, which clearly sets forth, if there were an issue with respect to standing, that it clearly sets forth that Kidde has ownership of that patent, and therefore, when the case was filed in November 2005, standing in Kidde 2 should be without question. However, Your Honor suggested that they wanted to go back in Kidde 2 and get a ruling on that issue. Excuse me, in Kidde 1 to get a ruling on that issue by remand. They've raised the issue in Kidde 2. It's right before the court again in Kidde 2 because they in fact, in this case, Your Honor.
Which precise issue when you say they raised it?
The issue of standing. They've raised it again before Judge Tilley in the second case that was filed, Kidde 2. And they did it, by the way, that they did, in short, they brought a motion under Rule 12 for dismissal for lack of standing. So that issue, I think it's really,
That's in Kidde 2 that the motion was filed?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Now, the original Kidde 1 then, that was dismissed without prejudice and without any conditions.
That's right, Your Honor.
There's no indication in the judge's order as to why he did not impose any conditions.
That's also correct, Your Honor.
With respect to the determinations made for evidentiary materials, rulings were made in Kidde 1. Those did not carry over to Kidde 2.
That's correct, Your Honor. According to, as I understand the judge's order, those were trial management decisions for Kidde 2 that the judge chose not to impose on their cross motion for conditions. That those are trial management issues, particularly within the discretion of the trial judge, Judge
That's
Tilley.
Not with Kidde 2, though. It's with Kidde 1.
Pardon? I'm sorry.
It's only relating to Kidde 1, not Kidde 2.
If I understood your question, Your Honor, you were saying that you suggested that those rulings that had been made in Kidde 1 did not carry over into Kidde 2. And what I thought I was saying, Your Honor, is that that's correct. And the judge in Kidde 2, which is Judge Tilley, he's the one responsible for the trial management of that case, and he's the one that made those decisions that he was not going to impose those conditions on the management of the trial in Kidde 2. I mean, the issue, the primary...
Excuse me, in Kidde 1, if it had remained in place, Judge Tilley could have made the same decisions in that case as he could in Kidde 2, is that right?
He could.
Trial management. In other words, there was no res judicata or collateral estoppel effect as to eliminating motions, was there?
He could have made the same, you're right, Your Honor, he could have made the same decisions with respect to trial management. In fact, the big issue that of USI's concern, apparently, on the conditions is the exclusion of the Kidde's expert witnesses for the untimeliness of the expert reports in Kidde 1. That motion, or that order, in fact, Kidde had appealed that order to the judge. This was the magistrate's determination. Kidde had appealed it, but at the pretrial, and prior to the pretrial, the judge had not ruled on that appeal. So it's conceivable that in the management of Kidde 1, Judge Tilley could have reversed the magistrate at that point and allowed Kidde to introduce expert testimony.
Counsel, with regard to the dismissal of the counterclaims,
yes,
I understood your argument to be the dismissal of the counterclaims is harmless error. Are you admitting that it was inappropriate for the judge to dismiss the counterclaims in Kidde 1 as he did? At least the ones that I articulated very specifically that have nothing to do with non-infringement, invalidity, unenforceability, but rather instead focus on the antitrust and unfair competition thing.
Your Honor, if the judge's order is interpreted to dismiss the antitrust counterclaims, I would agree that under HR Technologies, that was a legal error. But as I read HR Technologies, it did not appear to me that the parties in that case addressed the issue of whether or not that error was harmless or not. And I contend that it was, if in fact they were dismissed, it was a harmless error, because those counterclaims, whether they are alive in Kidde 1 or whether they are reasserted in Kidde 2 against Walter Kidde, it makes no legal in my opinion, makes no legal difference.
In fact, wouldn't the district court have discretion to just consolidate it all? In fact, I think that might be what happened in HR Technologies when it went back.
Your Honor, that's exactly what happened in H&R Technologies, ultimately. We asked, in our opposition brief, we challenged USI to say, what's the harm and what's the legal prejudice that you've experienced because of the dismissal of counterclaims? And in footnote 4 of their reply, the thing they said to us was, well, we can't tell you that's work product. Well, if they can't tell us what the harm is, it seems there is no harm. And so the dismissal would be harmless, and therefore there's no reason to remand those counterclaims to the district court.
Could it be those expert reports might be a reason to do it? That you all don't get to take the experts to trial, but they do with regard to the counterclaims. And it's possible that if the counterclaims go back and Kidd have won, that the judge will continue to impose that same restriction.
Those counterclaims, Your Honor, that you're talking about, the ones that were, if dismissed, were improvidently dismissed, the ones on antitrust, because of lack of ownership, unfair competition under North Carolina state law. They had nothing to do with our experts. There was no expert testimony. The experts that were being offered at the time were not testifying on any of those issues. In fact, the counterclaims that we're talking about had been staged.
So the expert reports were limited to the really what we would call it, the hardcore patent issues.
The hardcore
like
patent issues.
Typically expect.
Validity, infringement, damages.
Did the judge assess costs and legal fees against Northrop Grumman?
No, Your Honor. My understanding of the order is that the judge did not assess any costs or fees. He did, because they had asked for those in, or at least they asked for fees. I don't specifically recall the subject of costs, but they did ask for their fees in connection with Kidd 1. And in denying their motion, the judge denied their request for fees. And as we have argued and set forth in our documents, Your Honor, the request for fees, those fees and expenses that were incurred in Kidd 1 are directly transferable, if you will, or applicable to the case in Kidd 2. They don't have to go back and take the discovery they took before. There are a lot of things that they have done in the case. In fact, they were ready for trial. There's a lot of fees in that. Directly applicable to Kidd 2, so there would not be any legal prejudice by the fact that they have to go into Kidd 2.
Wouldn't what you just said support the idea that there is potential legal harm not sending back the counterclaims, because they were ready to go to trial, you were ready to go to trial, you've both said as much in your briefs, so why couldn't they have an expeditious trial simply on the issue of their counterclaims, which pertain only to the issue of ownership? And that trial could go forward right away, whereas if we don't send them back, the legal harm might be that these have to be locked in with everything else, and you're at a new, you know, you have a new case filed, and that's going to take a lot of time before you get to trial.
There's a very simple answer to that, Your Honor. Those counterclaims were stayed pending the outcome of Kidd's claim of infringement, in their counterclaims of invalidity, and our claim of damages. The counterclaims had been stayed. So, in fact, and discovery on those counterclaims, antitrust issues, you know, the world of discovery that you have to take in an antitrust case, all of that had been stayed. Nothing had happened.
Discovery was stayed as well.
So they were not ready to go to trial.
Okay, thank you.
They're not ready right now.
Let me ask a question. Judge Moore had asked Mr. Kahn about the capping of damages or the impact of the lack of ownership of the patent on damages. Is there any difference in the way the damages would be calculated and whether the suit were proceeding in Kidd 1 or Kidd 2? I mean, any argument about ownership, time of ownership, is that going to be different in Kidd 1 or Kidd 2?
It would not be different in the case, Your Honor. I mean, they have the argument that if we didn't have ownership as of when we first filed the complaint and didn't have ownership or affect ownership until October 2003.
They got it either way, right?
Yes.
But from a practical standpoint, might it not help settlement if, for example, it's established on remand in Kidd 1 that there's no standing, there was no ownership until the subsequent letter? Well, then that eliminates even the specter of damages prior to that. greatly limits the amount they may owe you because they won't owe you from all the, for all those years from 97 up till 2003. And perhaps you all would then go away and settle this case for a smaller amount in light of the fact that the damages have been greatly reduced at the front end.
Your Honor, quite frankly, I doubt that that would practically occur because, as a matter of fact,
I hate hearing that.
The substantial portion of the damage occurred after 2003.
Okay.
If you had no damages in 2003 standing at that point, they could also still have their valid antitrust counterclaim.
They would have, they could still assert their antitrust counterclaim. I might mention, just occurred to me, Mr. Kahn referred to a November document that we received from the former owner of the patent. The October 2003 assignment did not, by its terms, specifically assign a claim for past damages. So the owner of the patent in November 2005 submitted, or we obtained from them, an assignment of claims for past damages.
That's not part of this record.
It's not part of this record, right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ron, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the first instance, I'd like to address, elaborate on my response to Judge Moore's question relating to Short. And that is, there appears to be a distinction being made that because USI did not file a motion for dismissal based on the lack of subject matter jurisdiction, that it's not entitled to the benefit of the ruling, so to speak, or the guidance provided by that ruling. But I'd like to direct the court's attention to page 5 of the decision, the final paragraph, and where the Fourth Circuit stated, in conclusion, this court is convinced that when there is a reason for the court to believe that it does not have subject matter jurisdiction, as in the case where there's an outstanding motion, then it must make that decision prior to disposition under Rule 41. I'd also like to point out that in the context of the argument, or Kitty's argument relating to, for example, judicial economy, and this is more directed to Judge Jordan's question about the opportunity in the Kitted 2 to raise the same type of defenses and make the presentation of the same type of evidence, it appears that we're not going to escape the need to review and go through all of the Hong Kong law and the applicability of the Hong Kong law or the foreign law. It's still not decided what jurisdiction controls, but in terms of the interpretation of that purchase agreement, we're still going to have to go through that exercise. So there's no, how should I say, there's no saving of judicial time or economy as advanced by Kidd by simply shortcutting and filing the second suit to the prejudice of USI.
Well, let me ask you something. You said to the prejudice of USI. If there's, explain to me the prejudice aspect of that. I think I understood you say there wouldn't be shortcut doing it in the second action, but if it went back in the first action, you'd be doing the same thing, right?
Actually, Your Honor, the burden of proof is on Kidd, and they had not presented anything, developed anything in the first action that would support the contention, and therefore it would be our position that they would be unable, based on the condition of the first action, to have established that they were the owner.
That argument as its premise, though, that if you went back in Kidd 1, that the presiding judge would say, we're not letting you develop any evidence or present any arguments that weren't presented before. You've got to go with what was there before, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, yes, it would dovetail with the motion to eliminate, but they certainly would not be allowed to bring in, for example, witnesses or the like to attest to this information in Kitted 1.
I'll push a little bit on that because it's a significant thing. Are you suggesting that there is some preclusive effect to rulings that were made in Kitted 1 that means that the evidence available in Kidder 2 is going to be substantively different than would be available if Kidder 1 came back to life.
Let me see if I understand the question.
I don't know if I articulated
that. No, right. You did fine. I understand. And that is, in the event that we would proceed with Kidder 2 in lieu of Kidder 1, would there be any substantive change in the evidence between Kidder 1 and Kidder 2?
Right. Your earlier comments seemed to imply that, boy, if we were back in Kidder 1, we'd be better off on the USI side because those guys in Kidder wouldn't be able to bring in other stuff that they could bring in Kidder 2. Now, maybe I misread you.
No, that's
what you're saying. I want you to be specific and tell me what.
All right. For example, again, they would not be able to substantiate the any contract interpretation. They had no witnesses that they had identified or prior to the close of discovery that they had identified that could attest to this subject, to this issue.
But the premise of that, though, is it not, is that a Kidder 1 trial judge would say, I'm not letting you bring that in because it wasn't earlier in the case.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that is correct.
No, I don't understand.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case submitted.